sometimes if I can try and name that it's perfectionism, I will say, okay, like you have to ship it. Like there's a deadline. If I'm on a contract, there's a very clear deadline. When the deadlines are self-imposed, it's very hard to know when is enough. And that's, again, when I think community is great. You know, when you're co-writing with somebody, you start to feel tired and you say, okay, I really don't think I can look at this document much more. I think I'm, you know, moving horizontally instead of vertically. Like it's getting different, but I don't know if it's getting better. That will help me stop. But it's hard to know when you're being a perfectionist and when it's actually just cooking.
Hi there, and welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your host and fellow student. In this episode, I spoke with Joy Batra. Joy is equal parts corporate and creative. She graduated from Harvard Business School with a JD MBA when her life took an unexpected turn. Instead of practicing law, she wound up pursuing a Bollywood acting contract and started freelancing on the side to finance her dream. This experience caused her to write and publish a book, The Freelance Mindset. In our episode, Joy talks about her interests in creativity across many different disciplines, and especially how her learnings have translated back to the corporate world. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
All right. Well, welcome, Joy. I'm so excited to have you here today. Thank you for being with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here too.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to dig into your creative path and so much that you've learned along the way. But I would love to start with taking you back to your childhood and thinking about you age, you know, 7, 8, 9. If you think about yourself at that age, in what ways did creativity come out?
Yeah, I think I was really lucky as a kid because my dad absolutely loved creativity. And one of my favorite memories is a little bit before the age of 7. I think I was 6, but no calendar will be able to show. He invited me to join him at work, and he was a manager at a big company. And that day he was doing something special was he was teaching a creativity workshop to his colleagues. And it was a little side hustle and a passion of his to really explore creativity. And I think that it was a very beautiful way for him to live and navigate through this world because my dad immigrated from India to the United States in the 1970s, maybe even a little earlier than that. And there wasn't kind of the same sense of connectedness across the globe that we have today. And so for an immigrant finding their path, there's always the sense of, I'm a little bit different than the people around me. And one way he was different was, of course, he was born somewhere else and had grown up somewhere else. But another thing that he constantly pointed to was, I'm creative. I think creatively, and I think outside of the box. And that's something that makes me so much stronger than if I didn't. And so he really, you know, brought that up at every dinner table conversation, every time there was possibly a misunderstanding. Oh, well, it's because you're creative and you're seeing things in a different way. And that's really a superpower. And so I think I'm really blessed to have had that upbringing and to value creativity and to look for the different ways that it can inspire my life.
That is so interesting and so wonderful to have that influence so early on. How did it show up for you? Like, were there certain disciplines that you pursued or how did it impact your childhood?
Yeah, I feel like as an only child, and we also moved a lot as a kid, so I was also very different. You know, moving from New Hampshire to Indonesia to Korea to all over places, again, pre, you know, social media and the connection that we have now. And I think connecting with creativity in this way let me take risks and really let me take pride in being different. And so I remember in middle school, I think we all had to play the recorder, but then we got to play an instrument and choose what we wanted to play. And I chose the trumpet, and I was the only girl who chose that. But not only did I choose to play the trumpet, I got the biggest, reddest case that you could. It was super bright, and it stood out, and everyone else had a sea of black cases, whether they were playing trumpet or flute. And I just wanted to be different. I wanted to be colorful and express my individuality, and I felt very safe doing that, at least as a kid.
Yeah, well, that makes so much sense from your dad's influence and his pride in being different and creative. And then, you know, having you choose an instrument like the trumpet. That's such a great story. I love that. So, okay, I would love to fast forward a little bit. So you have a really interesting story in that you graduated from Harvard with a double master's in law and business. And ultimately decided afterwards to pursue Bollywood dancing and acting, which seems like was a major inflection point in your life.
That's the understatement of a century.
So I would love just to hear a little bit about that and how that decision really shaped your view of life and career.
Yeah. Inflection point is such a great way of framing it. But I think the seeds actually started earlier, of course. So after college, like a couple of weeks after I graduated college, my dad passed away and I started working at an investment bank. And this was right after the financial crisis, and I had gone on nearly 100 interviews to get that job. And it was my dream job, and I felt very, very lucky to have it. But about 3 months in, I came home, I sat on the couch, and I opened my computer or my phone to send another email. And I remember thinking distinctly, is this it? Like a 22-year-old, like, okay, part of it was grief. Like, that was very early to be asking that question. But at the same time, it just had seemed really bizarre to me that all through my childhood, I was expected to have extracurriculars so that I could put them on my application and get into a good college. And then Bollywood dance had helped me not only, you know, get into programs, but it helped me get this job because I talked about it in my interviews and it was a great story. And now that I had the job, suddenly I was expected to do nothing other than work, and that somehow just didn't compute to me. And so after like some extended period of feeling this sluggishness of where did my extracurriculars go? Where is the rest of me? I found a Bollywood dance class and it gave me so much energy to go through the rest of the week, and I couldn't wait for the next one. And so I had already found ways to fit it into my life because I realized I needed that to be able to do my best at work, at life, and anywhere else. And so now this inflection point at graduation, I had signed a job offer I was very, again, lucky and excited to have gotten at a law firm, you know, in the exact specialty of law that I wanted to practice. But being in a law firm is different because you bill by the hour, you're in a client service business, and I knew I was really signing up for no autonomy over my schedule, that there was going to be a change in me at the end of a couple of years working there, and I didn't know in what direction. And I just felt this sense of loss and maybe a little bit of fear of wondering who I would become and letting go of this part of me. And so the reason kind of like behind kind of the random serendipitous nature of getting to go to Bollywood was I'd been kind of taught in business school that now was the time to take risk. I was in my 20s. I was healthy. I had student loans, but I didn't have a mortgage. So I felt I had, you know, a certain amount of freedom to go and take the risk. I was the only one kind of being affected by it. And that brought me to vacation in India and like dabble in taking an acting class. And when I got the audition and then the acting contract, it felt like a very now or never kind of moment, because even if this opportunity existed after a couple years of working at a law firm, I knew I'd be a different person. And I wanted to celebrate the person I was in that moment and honor it by pursuing this activity instead.
Wow. Well, and I love that you said, you know, in growing up, we do all these extracurriculars. And then, you know, when we take on a career, we're often the perception or the assumption is that we're just going to work and we're just going to pursue that. And so I'm curious, like, because you wound up, you know, pursuing more of a freelance lifestyle and writing a book about it, actually. So how did that decision kind of open your mind as to what a career could look like?
Yeah, it was like my mind got cracked wide open, because all through law school, very understandably, career services is teaching you how to get a job at a law firm. And if not a law firm, maybe in-house as a lawyer. It makes perfect sense, right? Business school had, I think, more breadth in the kinds of careers that we could pursue. But I mean, it was business school. And so most of the career paths available or discussed were at corporations, naturally. And so when I went to India, I had these loans that I mentioned, but I also had a lot of time between auditions, and I wanted to do something that was kind of grounding, that was interesting. And that's how I stumbled into freelancing. But it was such a confusing time because none of my law school friends, none of my business school friends, nobody I knew was doing anything even remotely like this, at least not in the beginning. As I got deeper into like making a community in Mumbai, the people that I met were kind of like me. They were slashies or multi-hyphenates, and many of them were engineers, a lot of them kind of at their parents' insistence a little bit. And then they had, you know, escaped to the big city and come to follow their dreams of being a model or an actor or a fashion designer. And we were all living in this in-between space. And so seeing how some of them worked part-time, worked freelance, you know, sometimes for U.S. corporations, but then still had time to go and pursue their business, pursue their dreams. That's when I started to feel like I had my tribe. But in the beginning, I didn't know. All I know was I needed money and I needed time. And the only way I could figure it out was freelance. And I was really embarrassed to tell anybody that that's what I was doing because I was following my intuition. I didn't have a plan. And it was very hard to articulate in that moment how it was all going to wrap up nicely with a bow. So it was kind of rediscovering what a career could be and what I was actually solving for with work in the first place, which was, you know, money, skills, and some structure.
Well, and I think it's also, hearing you talk, like the concept of identity comes up, right? Because it's so challenging to describe what you're doing if you're living that more portfolio career or multi-hyphenate life. And there's also a big sense of loss, perhaps, of an identity that you were attached to. And maybe a reluctance to take on a more creative one. So I'm curious how you thought about that concept of identity then and also how you think about it now.
Yeah, when I started my career, so I guess early 20s, but then also after grad school, I was really completely identified with my career. Like I had landed the job that I had wanted, luckily, but like it was the job that I had sought after. And so I felt a lot of pride right after college when I would share my job or like share where I was going to school. And it felt like it was a shorthand for who I was. And then all of a sudden, yes, I wasn't telling anyone where I had gone to school. It didn't even matter in an audition. All that mattered, could you act? Could you dance? And it was really disorienting to say, wow, okay, all of the markers that I had for like, who I am, who my friends are, like what I see for my future, all of those are gone. It was great. It was, again, like really very lucky to have gotten to act. But the challenge that I had with it was I think that I was in the beginning of my acting journey. I didn't really kind of have a long-term plan for being there. And I hadn't gotten very far in it, right? I had taken a class, I had gotten an audition and a contract. And then as months passed, I had done like a handful of gigs. I hadn't, you know, had something that was really massive and shorthand. And all of a sudden I could attach a new identity to this. I was an actor, but I was a struggling actor. And that was even more confusing. And so I think that was the beginning of a long journey of separating my identity from my work. And I think that journey continues today because even as a multi-hyphenate, it can be really tempting to say, well, I am this and this. And that's really, I feel great about it because those are the things that I, you know, value and respect. And I want to share those with the world. But when either of those is, you know, maybe in flux or is in a different stage of the journey than we'd want it to be, maybe it's a little earlier along than we'd like, that can be hard to share. And I've noticed this with other creatives and multi-hyphenates that I talk to of, you know, they have a hobby, they have an interest, but they haven't devoted a lot of time to it recently. And so they feel uncomfortable sharing that they like to dance or they like to paint, even if they've only gone for like a painting class in the last year and it was like the highlight of their last year. There is kind of this reluctance to accept that the beginning of the journey is still part of the journey and we can share that and we can celebrate that.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think there's like a shyness that comes with it at the beginning and like it feels so big to embody the identity of an artist, especially, or of some kind of creative. And so there's this reluctance to do so, right?
Yeah. And I remember the day in acting class, like it was a 3-week class. And I remember the day that three of us decided we were just going to start introducing ourselves as actors to the next person we met. And it was this massive shift. It felt like very risky. And it wasn't, you know, for a while we said, oh, I'm an acting student or I want to be an actor or this or that. And one day we just decided we're going to go out there and we're going to say we're actors. It was terrifying, but it was a milestone. And it was a moment where we said, okay, like this is the life that I'm pursuing. This is it. Like I am an actor, whether I'm an in-work actor or an out-of-work actor, I am an actor. And that's my life. And just kind of owning it was a big, scary step that I'm glad I had community support to take.
Yeah, I absolutely think community is such an important part of any creative work as well. Because, you know, you're going through the process and it takes so much time to get comfortable with it. So, yeah. So I'm also curious how you thought about like the balance between practicality and creativity and both in that time and now, because I think this is something that so many creatives struggle with. And yeah, so I'm just curious how you approach that.
Yeah, balance. I think that one of the lessons from business school that really stayed with me is a class we had taken called Authentic Leadership Development. And in that class, it was about how to craft a life. And there was this one particular module where they kind of encouraged us to be very critical of how much we actually need, because we get messages from society of what a lifestyle should look like and what growth looks like and what success looks like. But is that actually what we need, what we want? And so there was a moment when we had to, you know, write down on a piece of paper, what is this number that I can't remember if I could have this as a salary for every year or if it could be my net worth, but whatever, it was the number at which I would need to, I could stop working for money. And I think that there was some calculation, like there may have been a little game theory there where like the lowest number wins, but I don't know. I just remember that I was thinking, wow, okay, maybe it's a lot smaller than I thought. And I know the person to my right wrote like 100 million and the person to my left wrote zero because he was like, humans cannot be measured by dollars. And I was like, yes, both are valid. But I remember coming up with a pretty modest number, I think, that was roughly the size of my student loans at the time, and said, okay, if I have this much, I know that like, I think maybe money is not going to be front and center for my life. And I'm going to question that message that tells me that I need to buy more, that I need to have the fancier, more expensive apartment, and just think about what I would do if I already had $1 million. Like, you know, that old parable of, you know, there's the Harvard Business School graduate who says, oh, if I had, you know, millions of dollars, I would go to Mexico and then I could sit on the beach all day and watch the fish. And then there's a fisherman sitting next to him and he's like, you can do that now. You don't need the millions of dollars to do it. So that was kind of framing like both the fact that the amount I needed was less than what other people were telling me I needed, plus the fact that that was kind of like the best moment for me to take risk because I had the lowest amount of obligations in my life, I think allowed me to have more adventures, but live at a lower standard of living while I was having them. And so it was great. I, you know, got this room in Mumbai. It didn't have glass on the windows. It had kind of cockroaches all over the floor. First night I was woken up by pigeons in my room. It was not a place that I'd want to live now. But in that moment, to be following my dream, to get to go to my auditions, to my classes, like that was just a minor, like barely even noticeable inconvenience because the bigger picture was so much better. Now, as I get older, I'm back in the West. I am consuming a lot of messages that tell me I either now is my peak earning years or that job security is really on the decline. I find it a little harder to have that same balance of, you know, really going for passion over practicality. And so now I think that there are probably seasons where I focus on practicality and, you know, maybe like a couple of year stretches where, you know, work is front and center in my life. And then there are moments like when my book came out, I got to spend several months just promoting it, getting to meet people and be part of the community. And that was great. And I didn't, you know, make myself worry about when the next job will come in. I tried to really live in that moment, but it takes a lot of kind of inner listening to your intuition and trusting yourself, trusting that things will be okay. And even though I now have more years of data to back up the fact that I will hopefully find another job when I need one, I also have more years of, I think, fear stories where I can tell myself, you know, a moment was really difficult. And so I think just observing what story I'm telling myself in any given moment and how is it landing in my body? How is it making me feel? And is it even helpful? And then I really try to question that.
Yeah, no, that's such a great answer. And I think also the embracing the concept of seasons and, you know, it's not necessarily an either or, but it changes depending on where you are in your life. And choosing one right now doesn't excuse, you know, doesn't limit you from choosing another in the future. Well, so you wound up publishing a book on freelancing, the freelance mindset. And what was that process like? You know, what were some of the key learnings from writing that book?
Yeah, I mean, talk about like the beginning of the journey still being part of the journey. The journey for this book started 10 years prior when I was in India. I had to take Hindi classes. And as part of my Hindi homework, I would write stories in the language. And until that point, I had gotten good grades in writing in school, but I hadn't really enjoyed it. I kind of associated writing essays with all-nighters and a lot of stress. And it didn't seem like something I would ever do for fun. But in this moment where I was learning how to act and acting was hard, and I was learning how to speak Hindi and Hindi was hard, but I got to write a story. All of a sudden it felt easy and fun and my acting teacher really liked the stories. And that was strange because I was not even writing in my native language. I thought, okay, like maybe there was something to it. Like maybe what I'm writing, when I'm writing matters just as much as the fact that it is writing. So that kind of inspired me to go deeper into the writing journey. And I started writing this magical realism novel, which was truly terrible. I did finish it. It took me, I think, 5 years to finish that novel. I brought it to conferences and I showed it to agents and they were like, my God, this is awful.
Wow, that is so humbling to spend 5 years on a project. And
yeah, and they were like, maybe work with an editor. And I worked with an editor and it like wasn't getting better. Maybe it was getting worse. I don't know. But one of the agents that I met at that conference was so kind. She was like, okay, this is not the book, but I can see that you like to write. I can see that you have, you know, stuff to share with the world. Why don't you try nonfiction? Of course, my then boyfriend had also said, you know, babe, I think you should try nonfiction. And I was like, what?
Until you hear it from someone else.
But coming from her, it was fine. Yeah. So we were thinking about like, what in nonfiction could I offer the world that might be interesting, that might, like, I could enjoy writing and people might learn from? And it was really this path to freelancing. It was such a bizarre career journey that I had lived through and such a different way of thinking that I had developed. I wanted to share it. And so even that took 5 years, because we had this conversation in 2019 and, sorry, 4 years, and the book came out in 2023. So I think the biggest journey, the biggest lesson from this journey is, wow, things really take time. And to own that, especially in a creative life, it was so hard in 2018. You know, 4 years into this novel, people would ask me at dinner parties, oh, how's your writing going? And I'd be like, it's going. And then to, you know, follow it up in 2019, well, it went. So, I mean, really had to learn to give myself grace. And that's something I'm trying to relearn in this moment where I'm thinking about the next project. I don't know where it'll go. I have an idea. Will it be good? Will it not? I don't know. I do know it's taking far longer than I want it to. Like, I have the idea. I sat down to write it 14, 15 months ago, and I wrote a really long document, but I didn't like it. And it kind of captured the idea, but it wasn't resonating. It just didn't click. And I'm coming back to it, and I'm working on it. I'm just trying to polish it. And wow, I get into the flow. I enjoy it. I love it. Parts of it look really great. But wow, days pass, months pass, weeks pass. You know, like years might potentially pass before this comes out. And there's definitely a little bit of wanting to rush the process and having to remind myself that it's cooking. Like, if you take a cake out too early, you're not going to have a cake. You're going to have food poisoning. Like, you don't want that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think first of all, thank you for being here when you're in the middle of a creative project, because I think that's also just such an interesting point, and especially when it's something like writing and writing a book, which is such a long, long journey and long process.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for having me. And I think one of the things that I used to think when I was younger, or like first attempt at a book, was that I needed to kind of withdraw from society and like find some secluded place to go sit and write. And it would be very dreamy and romantic. And now at this stage in my journey, or with the experiences I've had, I feel that I need to do it in community. I need to be around people. I need to kind of feel that energy, that inspiration, that aliveness, and to call its name. Like, yes, I went to those dinner parties and I said I was writing. I mean, everyone politely said, oh, that sounds like a great idea. But, you know, that did keep me going. That did give me inspiration, gave me ideas. And so thank you for having me, letting me connect with it, connect with you and these topics. I think that brings the life to the work.
Yeah. Well, and this is a little bit meta, because the topic of your next project, right, is on the topic of creativity, which I think is wonderful. So we're kind of going deep into your creative process and talking about creativity in general. But what I think is so interesting about your story about writing your freelance mindset book is the fact that you really started that practice 5 years earlier with the novel. And so I'm curious how you've honed the ability to develop a practice, because I'm sure like there was so much learning from that first book.
Yeah. And I think at different stages in the journey, you need different things. And so I would be really remiss if I didn't mention what helped me the first time, which was my college roommate who was also writing a novel. And she said, do this thing with me. It's called NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month. And I think if a novel is 30,000 words, you write 2,000 words every day for the month of November. And at the end, you have a novel. And together we did this. I don't think I would have a draft if it weren't for like us sending each other word counts and memes and inspiration. But, you know, the process changes. And at that particular point in my life, like I would go to work and then I was a night owl. Somehow things have changed in 10 years or 5 years, but you know, I would come after work, sit down, and we would message each other. I would write, and that was the process. Then a little bit later, I was kind of on a deadline. Well, I was really on a deadline with the book. If it had taken me 2 years to write the book proposal, I only had 9 months to go from proposal to finished draft or like final copy. So then I had to have some structure that was, you know, more supportive of this need to execute on time. And so then I found a writing group that met in the mornings, and I would just meet them, get my word count in, and then go to work for the day because I didn't know what time work would end and how tired I'd be after all of that. Now, at this part of the journey, I think the process is different. I think I don't go to the same writing group like as regularly because I have other things I do in the mornings now. And, you know, I'll find co-working sessions with a friend or just take myself to the coffee shop, you know, try to get myself in the headspace and then connect with the topic and try to write then. And I think to just honor wherever you are in the process, like, what do you need to feel moving forward motion, to feel support, to feel connected to your topic, your craft, your work, and to find the fun in it? That's really hard sometimes, especially when it doesn't look like what we imagined in our heads, or, you know, we have a deadline coming up, and to remember that we're doing this primarily because we like it, right? Like, this is fun. There is some aspect of what we're sharing, what we're doing, that's expressing a piece of ourselves that we want to share, that needs to be voiced, and to, you know, do whatever it takes to get into the headspace for that. And coaching can be really helpful. I've had great experiences with one coach on my last book, and she would help me connect to the inner part of myself that represented this book or that wanted to be heard or wanted to speak on this topic. My current coach is really great at helping me think about, like, what is the feeling I want to have when I'm writing, when I'm reading, or after the book is successful, and to get into that headspace when I'm creating. But it really is, as one of my friends says, like, really just a matter of getting out of your own way. Like, we find so many ways to block ourselves. So how can we undo that and connect with the version of ourselves that needs to be connected with in this moment?
Yeah, no, that is such a great point. And so I love what you said, first of all, community, finding these writing groups and finding ones that work with your schedule and ones that, you know, probably change over time and evolve. And sometimes maybe needing more from a community, sometimes being able to cultivate it yourself, but also tapping into like the inner parts of yourself that are excited about the project.
Yeah, especially when you get criticism. I mean, you know, I can laugh about the first book. I don't think my entire soul was wrapped up into that book. But when I was, this is the magical realism novel, not the freelancing book. The freelancing book, that one was a little tougher because when I finished the proposal and I showed it to agents, or I think, you know, started to get some early feedback on it, you know, it was really hard to hear that. And so getting to have that support of the community, everyone in my writing group had, you know, been through a situation where somebody didn't like their idea, or they had gotten edits that they didn't, you know, agree with, or, you know, just somebody didn't see the vision. And so getting that support, getting that encouragement to keep going, and then passing that on to others, because inevitably someday somebody else would be in that stage of their journey, and it can be painful. But yeah, community is a huge, huge, huge part of the creative process for me.
Yeah. Well, and you were starting to talk about getting out of your own way, and I think perfectionism is such a challenging concept for artists, creatives to get over. How have you? What's been your experience with, you know, making progress in that? Because I think there's it's never ending, but just curious how you've reframed a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because perfectionism takes different forms for me depending on the medium. So we've talked a lot about writing, but I do also love to dance. And I also like to paint, and that was a pandemic hobby. And you can kind of see, I can't remember the name of this effect. I don't know. I won't try to name it, but you know, there is the effect of the more of a novice you are, the less capable you are of, you know, finding the holes in your own work, and the more overconfident you are in your abilities.
Yeah, I relate to that.
Yeah. And so with painting, I don't feel a whole lot of perfectionism because I've not been formally trained in that. And for me, it was just a volume game and a feelings game. So I wanted to get the emotion out. And sometimes I would like the way it looked on paper or on canvas. And other times, it wouldn't really matter what it looked like because A, I wasn't attaching my identity to it, but B, like, I didn't even know how to evaluate what good was. It was just like, okay, fine, I'll move on to the next one. And painting is one of those, you know, more private mediums where you don't have to show it to anybody unless you want to. In general, you're kind of doing this in the privacy of your own home. Writing is similar in that you don't have to show it to anyone if you don't want to. But I've spent so much time around words, you know, and I've trained as a lawyer. And so precision in language is very important. And I've read a lot of books that I absolutely adore. And so I have a very clear sense of what good looks like to me. And when I look at, you know, some things like an early draft that I write, sometimes it can be hard to finish the draft because I know it's so far from what I want the end product to be. But trying to remember that there's going to be a next draft and there's going to be a draft after that. Sometimes that's inspiring. Sometimes that makes me feel like, oh my God, there's so much more work left to be done. And that's kind of where I take inspiration from my day job and from corporate work, where, you know, I've spent many years at startups, but now I'm working at, you know, freelancing for a bigger company. And I think timing is everything. And I think having something good enough to ship so that you can stay on schedule, so that you can keep things moving, not block somebody else, really forces you to finish up and say, okay, this is good enough, and move on. And so when I see myself dragging sometimes, and sometimes if I can try and name that it's perfectionism, I will say, okay, like, you have to ship it. Like, there's a deadline. If I'm on a contract, there's a very clear deadline. When the deadlines are self-imposed, it's very hard to know when is enough. And that's, again, when I think community is great. You know, when you're co-writing with somebody, you start to feel tired and you say, okay, I really don't think I can look at this document much more. I think I'm, you know, moving horizontally instead of vertically. Like, it's getting different, but I don't know if it's getting better. That will help me stop. But it's hard to know when you're being a perfectionist and when it's actually just cooking. Like, some ideas do really take time to develop. And that discernment, that wisdom, I think can only come with volume and experience. I don't think I have it yet, given that I'm on like maybe my fifth writing project. I have a couple of other abandoned novels that I started very, very excitedly and realized I didn't have the stamina to finish. But yeah, maybe when I'm several books in, I will be able to name it and I will be able to know it. Maybe I'll have worked through perfectionism at that point, but I think it's part of becoming an artist and I think it's part of letting go. I think all the best we can do is call each other out on it when we see that our friends may be getting in their own way. And I've really appreciated when friends have told me, oh, are you doing that thing in your head where you think there's this perfect ideal and you will never reach it? Like, maybe just don't do that and finish, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's great to have friends like that and to be able to do it to yourself.
Yeah. If you can get out of your own fog and realize that's what's going on.
Yeah. So you started to mention some of the learnings between corporate and creative, and you describe yourself equal parts corporate and creative. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about that. Like, what lessons have you taken from the creative world into the corporate world and from the corporate world into the creative world?
Yeah. Oh, this is like my favorite topic of all. So from the corporate world to the creative, I mean, I think like the lessons are, there's the society that we live in is kind of very much dominated by the corporate. And I think it's important to name that. I mean, for most of the things that we do, we're kind of measured against corporate standards. And, you know, even things like goals of maximizing income as kind of things that we think about as growth, or having an apartment, having your own place, those are status symbols of like adulthood, but those are very corporate status symbols as well. I think the corporate piece can teach artists a lot. Part of it is about running your art like a business. And to some extent, if you want to have a creative career, you need to think about how are you going to, of course, maximize revenue, minimize costs, market it to the target audience and convert those people into sales. And I think there is a lot of learnings because being a freelance artist is running your own business and wearing all of those different hats at the same time. And I think corporations are really good at, you know, iterating, at learning, and at measuring progress. And I think they're very data-driven. And so you have the concept of KPIs and OKRs. You set goals that can be measured. You make incremental steps toward them. Hopefully you meet your goals, but if you don't, you do kind of a postmortem and see where things went awry. And there's really this process for forward motion, for growth, for expansion that is in a very quantifiable, tangible, data-driven way, which I think benefits the artist. For me as a writer, yeah, it was really helpful to break down a 60,000-word novel into 2,000 words a day. I don't think I can keep up with that cadence like at every season of my life, but to say this big hairy goal I have has very incremental steps that I can just work through every day and I'll blast through blocks and I will just get there. That's really, really beneficial, especially in dry seasons, especially in moments where you are trying to expand and you don't know what expansion looks like. I think you can find a process for finding it through the corporate. Through the creative, I mean, that's where the to me, where the vibrance, where the problem solving, where the inspiration comes from. It's being different in a way that's beneficial and that makes you find unexpected solutions. And, you know, for a day job, that can be really great because you think about, you know, if you're a product manager or designer, you think about the different ways, the different jobs that need to be done, the different solutions you can find. But I think that being a creative also just gives you that resilience outside of work because you have something that you can really connect with on a soul level and that makes you feel fulfilled in a different part of yourself. And I think that that allows you to see different paths in your career, to think about, you know, whether or not you want to be full-time or freelance, whether you want a portfolio career, and not being afraid to do things differently than they were done in the past. And I think in corporations, there can be a lot of institutional knowledge, there can be a lot of tradition, but sometimes you need to change, and change takes bravery. And that bravery, a lot of times, comes from that creative side of ourselves that is doing something new because it needs to explore or because it's the right thing for that moment.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you said it takes courage and bravery. And I think you're right that, you know, pursuing something creative outside of work allows you to bring that energy, very similar to how you described, you know, with your dad at the beginning, just his ability to say, hey, I'm different, I'm creative, and then approach things in a different way, right? So something that comes up a lot too is related on this topic is like the different sides of our brain, right? Like analytical and creative. And I'm curious, like, how you see the relationship inside you, inside yourself, between those two parts of yourself.
Yeah, I'll answer the question about myself, but before I want to plug one of my friends slash you know, intellectual heroes, Sarah Beth Burke, and she's done a lot of research around. Well, being a multi-hyphenate and what it's like to have different strengths, they may be analytical and creative, but to have this kind of portfolio career. And she talks about how she uses the metaphor of a cake. And so you can have eggs and flour and sugar, and you can have them all be separate. You can have just eggs, or you can combine them together and make a cake. And so I think some people are specialists, and that would be just the egg situation. Some people are, she has a term for it where you have side-by-side careers, but you don't actually integrate them. And so that would be eggs and flour. And then some people like to live at the intersection of all their different talents and all of their specialties. And those are the people who would, you know, be the cake. And I think, you know, where I land on this spectrum is I'm probably eggs and flour. And I think that they are side by side tracks that I absolutely adore. And sometimes they will spill over. Like I definitely do see the corporate side kind of spill over when I think about building a writing career. When I think about, you know, what goes into marketing and promotion and will this book sell, who's the audience, that kind of thing. And also even sometimes my process for writing can be very, you know, quantitative and numerical. The creative side is tricky for me, has been tricky for me to sometimes bring into the corporate sphere. And, you know, there is another Sarah Beth phrase, which is optimal distinctiveness. And she may have quoted somebody else for this, so I'll check and we can put it in the notes afterward. But it's the right amount of standing out while fitting in at the same time. And human beings want both.
Wow, that's a really interesting concept. Standing out while fitting in at the same time.
Right, because you want to be part of the group, but at the same time, you want to be special and you want to, but in an accepted way. And finding that balance in the corporate world, I think takes some finesse and has taken me some time to figure out kind of what are the right outlets. I think in general, people are very interested to hear that I've acted, but in the office, they expect me to behave like an office worker. And that makes perfect sense. I wouldn't dream of doing anything differently. But the creative side in me, I think, does give me a little bit of courage. Like when I'm drafting a document and I know what the end goal of the document is, it's to persuade or to teach or something, and what the topic is. If it doesn't look like the same format as other documents that have been drafted on this matter, that's okay. I think that that has given me a little bit more of confidence in that. That also comes from like a decade plus of experience in the working world and kind of knowing the problem and the client. And I think the creative side, it's great for building relationships with your team. I think you get to bring a more authentic version of yourself and talk about the things you really care about during that water cooler moment or when you're chatting on Zoom. And you kind of really recognize that common humanity that is bigger and broader than what, you know, specific job we are doing at the company. I think that's really where I felt it the most. And so yeah, that's what it's like when they're parallel tracks. But for somebody who is absolutely integrated, I would love to hear what their experience is.
I would too. I think that's such a great analogy, the cake and the eggs and the flour. And I think for me, it's sometimes even felt that they're in conflict, right? And so I think the more you can embrace that, you know, creative acts take both sides of your brain, and analytical work and corporate work takes both sides of your brain, and they're not this either or, but it's more of an and.
Yeah, we love to have binaries and conflicts in our society. And so finding the and can take some work, but it's really worth it when you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know your current project is all about creativity. So I'm curious just what some of your learnings and observations have been, and maybe like any beliefs that you've changed in yourself as a result of this research.
Yeah, I'm still in the early stages of exploring it. And as I said before, the beginning of the journey is still part of the journey. So I'm trying to embrace that. but what I'm really trying to understand is like, what is this, you know, corporate creative archetype that now exists? I think in the past, everybody is creative kind of just on a fundamental level. Not everybody did, you know, exercise their creativity in a way that could be consumed by the public or could be commercialized or sold. And we're now in a different space where I think there is opportunity, maybe pressure, to be able to bring both of all of our many skills to the forefront and to possibly commercialize and sell them. And I'm trying to unpack where that comes from. I think that, you know, the opportunity is largely like tech, education, affluence, a little bit of stability. But the pressure, I mean, I think maybe, you know, some of it can be traced back, and we'll follow up when I've done more research, but, you know, can be traced back to this idea that, you know, like as children, we were allowed, encouraged to be able to express and explore different activities and really got to sample kind of all the opportunities available. And then extracurriculars became really important for school, I think, because academic just achievement had skyrocketed. And I think that's a great thing. And then once the extracurriculars go away, I think, you know, we're left with a little bit of a gap in our lives. I mean, those extracurriculars, many of us continue, the ones we stayed with, we enjoyed for the most part. I think the ones we didn't like, we dropped relatively early if we could. And so we held on to things that were important parts of our identity, of our upbringing, of, you know, who we saw ourselves as in the world. And we have in some ways more time than we have that other previous generations have had. I mean, people are getting married later, or having kids later. Some are choosing not to have kids at all. So that opens up time and money that wasn't there in the past. And, you know, we can talk about women having, you know, more financial freedom than in prior generations as well. But I think it's a really beautiful thing to see people create these, you know, multiple careers at the same time and to really be able to shine in different domains in different ways. And I think in general, we're becoming more tolerant of that because we're seeing more examples, celebrating more examples of it. And I think, you know, I'm really excited to see what the generation after Gen Z looks like on this front. And maybe they completely take it for granted that, like, of course you have a side hustle and of course you are a creator and a dancer and a lawyer and all of the things at once. Or, you know, maybe they won't. The pendulum might swing the other direction. But I think the big learning is that we are really being encouraged to be curious, to kind of get to know the different parts of ourselves and to allow those different sides of ourselves to grow and to foster. And it's very legitimate to invest your time in something that maybe earns less money than your day job. Maybe it earns more money. Maybe it doesn't earn anything at all. But for it to be a part of your identity, I think, is now accepted in a way that wasn't there in the past. And I'm really kind of at the beginning of the journey, but I'm just so excited to find out, you know, how this is impacting the way people are living and working and what's driving folks and where the conflicts are. So that's what I'm diving into right now, but I will report back when I know more.
No, that's so fascinating. And I think you bring up a lot of really interesting drivers. And I think also technology and AI and ChatGPT, which is enabling everyone to be an entrepreneur and pursue any kind of creative outlet that they want, is another contributor. But then also, I think it's interesting, like, do people choose to monetize or not? And is there a pressure in our society to move towards monetization? Do you have to monetize? Like, there's so many interesting questions relating to this. So I'm excited. I think we're all excited to read your book in 5 years.
Yes, in 5 years, we'll come back.
Well, so I'll start to wrap up, but I'm curious, like, as a final question for you, why do you think that we create, and why do you create?
So I think, like, work for me comes from a very head place, and maybe there's like a little bit of, you know, there's like a very masculine energy around like my day job and around providing for myself financially and forward motion and progress. But where creativity kind of sits for me in the body is kind of in a deep place. Like, I don't know if it's in the bottom of the belly. Maybe it's even like below the earth, like I don't, or above, I don't know. It's very, very far. And at the same time, still part of me. And I think I like creating because I like to see what's possible. And I like seeing new things that didn't exist before and feeling like I can make something and have it be different and have it be special and sparkly or weird and bumpy and ugly. Like, I don't know. But it just is, it's a joy to make things and to try different art forms and to maybe feel like a child again is that very pure essence of myself and why I believe that we're all creative, like at our baseline, like we are, we always have been. So to me, it feels like a homecoming, but it also feels like an aliveness, a connection with the world, and a connection with the beyond, because I don't know where my ideas come from. They just seem to appear. It feels like magic, and maybe it is. And I want to honor and tap into that magic whenever I can catch it.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us, Joy. Really appreciate it. It's been wonderful having you. You are a joy.
Oh. Jenna, thank you. You are a joy as well. This has been an absolute delight. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my episode with Joy. To learn more about her, check out her website, joybatra.com. You can also find her book, The Freelance Mindset, Unleashing Your Side Hustle for Better Work, Play, and Life on Amazon. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more lessons.